Appeals, Inc., and for the 7th Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States in this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Gause versus BWM Mortgage. Mr. Leturner.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The issue in this case is whether the Truth in Lending disclosures regarding the Geis's mortgage understated the finance charge by more than $900, which is the Truth in Lending deviation tolerance applicable to this transaction. Title insurance charges may be excluded from the finance charge only if they are both bona fide and reasonable. However, all mortgage brokers' fees or compensation are required to be included in the finance charge. The question here is whether the fees and charges that we are dealing with were for title insurance or were for mortgage broker's compensation. The Geis's were charged $1,595 total, purportedly for title insurance.
Well, now, your opponents argue that it hasn't been until this court that the line of the $450 line 1102 on the form was allegedly a premium or fee. They say that that $450 is just a title search, which is title search is obviously not title insurance.
Title search is a basic part of the title insurance fee.
Well, it's a different function. I mean, you ensure later on the fact that the representations about the soundness of the title are true. And so if somebody then comes along and sues and says, no, this is really my property, the title insurance company pays for representation. That the function of searching the title to see what encumbrance is on it is a different function. In any event, the point is a bigger one in a sense. There's this $450 line, there's the $800 line, there's the $345 line on the TUD form, and their argument is it wasn't until we get to this court that you claimed that the $450 line had anything to do with this. You were talking about $1,145 before.
We had the exhibit was attached to the complaint, and as I say, I think that is clearly considered actually within the regulation and the act. They talk not only about title insurance, but they also talk about abstracts of titles and title search.
Well, I know, but if we want to get to the language of the statute, you have the other problem that your opponents have raised, which is that the term finance charge is defined in a way that excludes fees and premiums for title insurance.
If I may go back to your original point,
right,
where you had I think the complaint shows that the full title fees are $1,595.
But not if you're just relying on this exhibit, because frankly, the exhibit has lots of lines on it. It has $50 for a settlement fee, and if you didn't specify earlier which ones of those lines you think are the problematic lines, I think that's a real difficulty.
We clearly focused on the $1,145
right,
that went to Clearwater Title.
Right.
Because the entire $1,145 we allege that went to Clearwater Title is clearly a mortgage broker's fee and therefore is not bona fide no matter which way you look at it.
Well, you didn't only say that. You also compared it to the amount that you thought a reasonable, or the amount that another company, I won't even put a label on it because I know you can test that, but the amount that Chicago Title would have charged, right?
We did put in examples from what other companies charge, and I believe we gave three of them in the amended complaint. They all had different figures.
Well, let's not talk about the amended complaint, which is a separate issue. Let's talk about the complaint that's before us.
Well,
the complaint that, are you talking about the complaint that the district court didn't accept or a complaint that it did accept?
I'm talking about the amended complaint, which the district court read, considered, said it didn't add anything to the complaint and then denied its leave to file it. I think once the district court read it and considered it and said it would not change her result, the amended complaint is clearly before this court.
Only in the sense that you're arguing that it was an abuse of discretion not to allow you to have it, though.
That is correct. But we would ask the court to consider it. We also have pointed out, we have showed to this court some of the evidence that we can submit in support of our position, which comes from the recent deposition of Mr. Robbins, one of the defendants.
But how can that possibly be before this court? Your opponents have moved to strike that, all those references.
In this court's opinion, in the Highsmith case, in the Smith case, it has been made very clear that evidence in support or what the evidence should show can be submitted for the first time on appeal. And that this court considers it. I can't find directly the quote from Smith, but it's in the Smith case, it's in the Highsmith case. There are several others, and in fact, even in their motion to strike, they say facts in support of a complaint on a motion to dismiss can be submitted for the first time in the appellate court. That shows that Clearwater pays two other companies, one to do the abstract and title search, one to issue the policy, approximately $420, which is a little bit less than the $450 here, and they only show it going to one person. But I think that two things. I think the entire $1,595 is before the court, and it's a title insurance charge. Second, the entire $1,145, which was paid to a shell corporation, a shell title insurance company that paid a few hundred dollars to another company to issue the insurance and then to add an extra $1,145 on so that they can evade the restrictions on mortgage broker fees under Illinois law, is not bona fide in any extent. It is actually a mortgage broker's fee. Under this case decision in Adams versus Plaza, you have to look to the substance of the transaction and not to the label that they put on it. What we are saying here is that the entire $1,145 paid to Clearwater Title, again, the shell corporation, is not bona fide and is a mortgage broker's fee, and it has to be included.
If the rescission remedy that you seek were granted, would the brokers get their fees back? I mean, when we unwind this whole transaction, the brokers have to disgorge fees, the title insurance companies have to disgorge fees to people who perform services such as title services, title search functions,
that
have to remain uncompensated for the services they perform, real estate class. I mean, how much gets rescinded, in other words?
What happens on the rescission is that the loan is nullified and everything that the borrower has paid is applied to principal. When you deduct the amount that they have paid, the entire amount from the principal amount of the mortgage, then the borrower has to pay that amount of money back to get the rescission. They do this through refinancing. I'm not sure how it works out between all the parties that came in on the other side, title insurance and so on.
Well, that
would be worked out between the lender and the contract that they have with other parties in this case.
I'll tell you the reason I ask, because when you look at the statutory structure and you see, obviously under the Truth in Lending Act, regulations about the amount of finance charges, in essence, it's the lender who charges a certain amount of money for the use of the money, the finance charge, if you will. And it makes perfect sense if the lender has not properly disclosed what that amount will be beyond the tolerances built into the statute, that rescission is an appropriate remedy. All these other parties out there, brokers, insurance companies, title search people, settlement fees, don't fit into that paradigm as well. So I'm wondering whether this is actually the right remedy for the kind of offense you're charging with respect to these middlemen. You're not saying that the lender did anything wrong, are you?
Yes, the lender misdisclosed the finance charge. It understated it by an amount greater than the tolerance.
Which requires us to agree with your definition of finance charge. Maybe you could turn to that for a second.
Okay. The finance charge, as set forth in the Truth in Lending Act, includes not only what we think of as interest on the principal, but it includes other types of charges, some credit charges, some other types of charges.
Right, and what about this language in 1605E1? Items exempted from computation of finance charge when it's real estate, you know, secured by real property, include 1, fees or premiums for title examination, title insurance, or similar purposes.
That's excluded. Regulation Z with the Federal Reserve Board fulfilling their duties under the Act to enact regulations says that those fees and charges for title insurance can only be excluded if they are both bona fide and reasonable.
Does Regulation Z conflict with the statute?
No, not at all.
It doesn't mention premiums, by the way. Regulation Z only mentions fees.
Regulation Z, one of the purposes of it is to prohibit evasion of the disclosures required under the Truth in Lending Act, particularly the finance charge. This is really almost their first and most important delegation. And what they are doing by...
But do you agree that the language of Regulation Z doesn't mention premiums?
Regulation Z does not mention the word premiums. It describes fees with regard to
title
and others.
Related matters.
Now, one of our basic allegations is that we're not dealing with a title insurance premium. We're dealing with an $1,145 mortgage broker's fee. And again, this is the Adams versus Plaza case. You don't look to the label they put on it. You look to the substance of the transaction. And this is a shell corporation that has been passing a mortgage broker's fee, an illegal one, on to the mortgage broker. So even if you say it doesn't apply to premiums, we're not dealing with a premium. We're dealing with hidden mortgage broker fees. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chairman. Mr. Gottlieb.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Richard Gottlieb. I represent one of the defendants' appellees, Homecomings Financial Network. I appear this morning on behalf of all appellees. Your Honors, we submit that the rulings of the District Court should be affirmed for 4 reasons. First, the disclosed finance charges were within rescission tolerances, no matter how plaintiffs allege the facts. Second, contrary to plaintiffs' assertions this morning, the title charges were indeed bona fide, because $1,145 was disbursed for title insurance, $1,145 was paid to Clearwater Title, and the parties received their title insurance.
But, you know, the problem is that this is a judgment on the pleading. You know, we haven't reached the summary judgment stage. So what if, consistently with these pleadings, everything that Mr. LaTurner argues turned out to be true? People can't just lie on these forms and label something as insurance premiums if they are nothing of the kind. How could that be bona fide?
I think, Your Honor, if what they said was true and was alleged in the original complaint or in the amended complaint, then there would be potentially an issue. For example, if they had alleged in the complaint that they did not receive title insurance, if they had alleged in the complaint that they had not received title insurance from Clearwater, The complaint alleges that paragraphs 21, 23, and 25, collectively, and again at paragraph 48, that, in fact, these parties received title insurance, albeit at double the prevailing market rates, from Clearwater. So I don't think there was an allegation on the pleadings when the judge made the decision that they did not receive title insurance. So you're right. If they had said, we never got title insurance, this $1,145 figure was a completely made-up fantasy, there was no title insurance, then your position would be correct.
But they've also alleged that the price was unreasonable, and you're kind of picking apart the form. The form's the form. And at the pleading stage, before we have any evidence whatsoever, for all I know, they could add up every number in that form and say it was all for title insurance and thus beyond the tolerances. Why do we get to look as far behind the face of things that you're asking us to?
I don't think we're looking beyond any face. I think what we're looking at in the context of a motion for judgment on the pleadings, and by the way, there was also a motion to dismiss filed by my client that was decided essentially on the same grounds, I think under the same standard. On the motion for judgment on the pleadings, the standard is the same as a motion to dismiss, and under that standard, you look at the four corners of the complaint with the attachments. On the basis of that, all the judge did here was perform simple calculations based on what was in front of her. And I think there was nothing wrong with that. I think the bottom line is that you don't look beyond the form. The form is the HUD one. You don't look beyond the complaint, the complaint's allegations. The complaint alleged $1,145 was paid to Clearwater Title at double prevailing market rates. And what was that prevailing market rate? That prevailing market rate was $601, and that was the rate that they said they got a quote from Chicago Title. Having set that prevailing market rate for title insurance as to these borrowers, plaintiffs are not entitled to a jury trial. That is what they're seeking, a jury trial, or at least making it a question of fact on the reasonableness of those rates. And finally, my fourth point is that new allegations concerning the $450 paid to non-party Lakeshore Title are waived because they're inconsistent with the allegations below. Addressing the first point.
But let me get back to, you filed a motion to strike with respect to this testimony from the deposition, but it's quite true that on a 12B6 type standard, a 12C type standard, if one could even imagine facts along the lines of this man's deposition, Mr. Robbins, that's acceptable. Any facts that could be proven consistent with the allegations of the complaint have to be assumed as part of what the plaintiff might do. So the fact that it is actually a deposition isn't really a fact of evidentiary significance right now so much as an illustration of the fact that something could be out there consistent with the complaint. Why in that light shouldn't we read this record as though somebody could prove that?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. First of all, the general rule is that, of course, things that are outside the record.
But that's what I'm saying. This isn't the record so much as an illustration of what could be perhaps proven consistently with the complaint.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that the allegations that are set forth in the reply brief, in the appellant's brief, and in the Mike Robbins deposition transcript are completely inconsistent with the complaint that was pled below. The complaint that was pled below was a theory of disguised mortgage broker fees related specifically to Clearwater Title. And what that talked about was a payment to a, quote, C or D rated company at $1,145 as being double the market price, which they quoted at $601. On that basis, they were dismissed out of the case because it was within rescission tolerances. On that basis, the court looked at the proposed amended complaint and said it was futile. There were no allegations that were related to the title search, which is a big part of the Mike Robbins deposition. There were no allegations concerning the idea that there was another company out there who only paid $120 for title insurance, et cetera, et cetera. These are not consistent with the main theory going forward. The main theory going forward was that the title insurance paid for the Clearwater was double the prevailing market rate. And the prevailing market rate was $601. Even if you look at Mike Robbins' deposition, even if you look at it and you say, okay, fine, they only paid $120 for that insurance they got from Lawyer's Title, the standard is not how much was paid as a wholesale price by a broker or a title agent. The standard is the prevailing market rate. That's what's looked at in a bona fide and reasonable context. If title insurance premiums belong in the category of a category that can be only excluded if it's bona fide and reasonable, and frankly, we would suggest that's not what Regulation Z says. But if that is indeed the case, if it is indeed the case that title insurance premiums are excludable if bona fide and reasonable, the excludable portion is at least the prevailing market rate under every standard that's been cited by the plaintiffs. The prevailing market rate was established by them at $601.
Well, they don't ever call it that. They just say, here's something out there. And, of course, their position is once you've violated, once you've, in a sense, mislabeled this, the whole amount, the full 1145 counts against you for the tolerances, which is obviously an amount greater than 900 for this loan. Not the netting out that the trial court chose to do.
Well, let me address that last point. It is our position that imposing that kind of a draconian result on lenders is contrary to TILA. If one were to place the entire $1,145 outside of the, turn it into the range of being an entirely finance charge, what you would lead to is a distortion of the true finance charge. The finance charge is supposed to be the cost of credit stated as a dollar amount. If you exclude the reasonable, the bona fide and reasonable portion, and remember, it was bona fide. They received title insurance. The reasonable portion, of course, is what they set, and I disagree with Your Honor on one point. You said they didn't say whether it was reasonable. They very much said it was reasonable. They twice described it as reasonable. Paragraph 23 of the complaint said that 1145 was twice the reasonable amount.
What I said is they didn't call it the prevailing market rate.
That is true, Your Honor. They did not. In the amended, in the proposed amended complaint, they used that language.
But not in the complaint
that,
Your Honor, the one to be before us. I do not, Your Honor.
Okay. I believe there's not much of a distinction for purposes of the argument, but you're right, as a matter of clarification, it was the phraseology that was used was reasonable. Getting back to my point, this would distort the true finance charge. The point of the Truth in Lending Act was to create a scenario where you had accurate comparison of credit rates. And the purpose of the Truth in Lending Act was very simple here. We want to make sure that borrowers, when they go out and look for a loan, can look at one loan versus another and say, which one costs me less? That's the one I want. And when you take the entire amount, rather than just the bona fide and reasonable amount, you distort the true finance charge. What you do is you make the loan issued by BWN appear more expensive than it actually was, because you're taking the bona fide and reasonable portion and you're taking it outside of the amount financed and sticking it into the finance charge.
Could I ask you whether your argument would be the same if, as Mr. LaTurner is now arguing anyway, we were to think that the $450 on line 1102 was the full amount paid even for the title insurance, and then that leaves the rest of this 1145 just a disguised fee?
Okay. In that situation, Your Honor, if it were truly a disguised fee, I think there would be an issue. I think that if you had a broker make something up, create a fiction, much like I think the Crisomia case, the Therian cases that are cited by appellants, I think that'd be a problem. I think that in the true label context, if a broker was committing a fraud, that would create an issue. For example, if the title search really were the title insurance, I think that would definitely be a problem in this case, and we might have to go back to the district court and have some fact finding. That's not what was alleged here, and frankly, based on the Mike Robbins testimony, that's not even what occurred here. What occurred here was that, in appearance, if the Mike Robbins deposition is brought into this case, it appears that the broker paid $120 and charged the consumer, the borrowers, $1,145.
Now, of course, so that's Clearwater Title who's doing all this.
That's Clearwater Title, exactly right. Now, that is not a case of a sham transaction. That is a case where there was a huge markup between the title agent and the title insurance's wholesale rate, which, by the way, didn't include any title search or any other functions. It was just the wholesale rate for the coverage.
And these separate endorsements.
And of course, there were separate endorsements. Exactly right. And so in the situation, even adopting the brand new theories that are out there, and using the Mike Robbins deposition, it doesn't change the result, because the bottom line is this was real title insurance provided by Lawyers Title. They really did get the services that they asked for. They really did get title insurance for their 1145. And therefore, the only question comes back to how much more than reasonable was this? And by setting a standard, quoting the $601, which I suggest, frankly, is a base number that isn't even a good number, but setting that as their number, the worst possible scenario, there was only a difference of $544 between the $601 that they claim is a reasonable amount and the $1,145 that they claim was an excessive amount. And so on that reason alone, I mean, you don't even have facts that get you there. And the second reason,
but by if their complaint had been devoid of numbers like this, do you think the proper thing would have been for the district court to deny the judgment on the pleadings and go forward to summary judgment?
I think you're right, Your Honor. I think that this would be...
They put too much information in your...
I think they pled themselves out of court. I think that this would have been much like a case like Ng in the Sixth Circuit or Branham in the Sixth Circuit if they had simply said... This is excessive and unreasonable. I think we would have had a tough time as defendants getting out on a motion for judgment on the pleadings. But by establishing a reasonable rate, they allowed the judge to simply perform the calculation. And the proposed amended complaint was clearly futile because even it set these prevailing market rates that was still within the differential. I want to cover one other point on why it distorts the finance charge. The second point is the tolerance itself, the tolerance language. Recall that in 1994 you had the Rodash decision. Rodash was a terrible result. It rescinded a loan based on a $22 courier fee. And what Congress did in reaction to that was created the tolerances in Section 1605 F1A and F2A. And the tolerances were the greater of 0.5% of the loan amount or $100. Now, what was the impact of that? The impact of that was designed to deal with situations just like this one, where a de minimis differential could cause a rescission. Now, what does 1605 F1A say? It uses the following language. A creditor will not be liable for a TILA violation if, quote, the amount disclosed as a finance charge does not vary from the actual finance charge by more than the tolerance amount. Now, Judge Aston was faced with this issue, this precise issue, in a very recent case called Quinn versus AmeriQuest. Now, we submitted that as part of our supplemental authority. What Judge Aston said was that this provision instructs courts to look at the difference between what was actually disclosed and what the finance charge would have been if the defendant had not been overcharged. Okay? Now, we did not argue this below, but it's an interesting reading of 1605 F1A. The point of the 95 amendments was to remove the rescission right for de minimis violations. Plaintiff's approach would allow borrowers to rescind if an otherwise bona fide and reasonable charge was a mere $1 in excess of the rescission tolerance amount. Now that can be, for example, in a foreclosure case now, $35. So now you have a situation where if you have a fee, a service fee of some kind, my time is up, Your Honor.
I have a question for you, but you want to complete your thoughts.
Yeah.
You should go ahead.
That would simply mean, Your Honors, that in a situation where you had a foreclosures are the most common form of cases where these rescission counterclaims are brought, a 35-cent overcharge, a 10-cent overcharge on a very small fee could create a rescission problem under their theory. I suggest that that's not an appropriate response.
Well, Mr. Godley, assuming the bona fide, that is the title issue, is it your position then that the language reasonable in amount in Z, in Regulation Z, is equivalent to anything under tolerance? I mean, in other words, you can't be unreasonable ever, no matter what the amount. Forget about the de minimis amount, because I'm thinking of obviously the right scenario. Can never be unreasonable if you're within the tolerance.
I don't think that's what the regulation states. I think what we're talking about is the degree.
Well,
the
regulation just says reasonable.
No, what the regulation is dealing with is trying to deal with amounts that could still be unreasonable, but are within tolerances. So yes, they can be unreasonable. For example, let's assume, as the court must do, that $1,145 was an unreasonable amount of title insurance, for title insurance. If that is indeed the case, what is the reasonable amount? The reasonable amount they set at $601.
Okay. Do you think there are other remedies, in other words, other than rescission?
Absolutely. Oh, for these plaintiffs?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, yes, of course. The count three was an Illinois Consumer Fraud Act claim. That's the perfect remedy for it, number one. Number two, as we described in the brief, this pretty much looks like a RESPA case. This looks like a kickback or a split fee case, and they could have brought it under that. They chose not to do so. I think the reason they chose not to do so, frankly, was because they wanted to bring more deeper pockets into the case under the Truth in Lending Act, but the very parties that had nothing to do with the transaction. That was the lender and the servicer. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Mr. LeTourneur? 2 minutes.
The tolerance. The tolerance was put in order not to unduly penalize lenders for small mistakes. What we're talking about here is fraud, systematic fraud. It's not to protect that. This is hiding a portion of the finance charge in the amount financed.
Well, why didn't you file a complaint that included the claims that counsel mentioned in his last point to us?
This is a Truth in Lending Act violation.
In terms of other alternatives, there were other alternatives.
We filed a Consumer Fraud Act claim against the all of the defendants, including the broker. The broker is not a defendant under the Truth in Lending Act.
But you're free to pursue those, right?
Those
were just dismissed.
That's correct.
Without
we can
prejudice.
Pursue them in state yeah. court, but I think that we are entitled to pursue the case here. We pled that the case, that the fee was not bona fide in the original complaint under notice pleading, that is sufficient. We also stated in the amended complaint that it was because that it was actually a mortgage broker's fee and not the other. And Mr. Gottlieb also mentioned that the guy has got title insurance, and I believe he pointed to the $450 charge to Lakeshore. That's correct. And that's why that $450 has to be considered when you determine what you're going to subtract for the tolerance. It also shows that the entire $1,145 charged by Clearwater was a fraudulent mortgage broker's fee. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.